owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept all those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as quota, and one should not accept other things well to whom they belong. The fourth, question of Prabhupada. Vedic knowledge is infallible, because it's down through the perfect disciplic succession of spiritual masters beginning with the Lord himself. The first word of Vedic knowledge was spoken by the Lord himself, and it is being received from transcendental sources. The words spoken by the Lord are called apodusheya, which indicates that they are not delivered by a mundane person. A living being who lives in a mundane world has four deep. One, he is certain to make mistakes. Two, he is subject to illusion. Three, he has a propensity to cheat others. And four, his senses are imperfect. So these defects are already described in the introduction. Being conditioned by these four imperfections, one cannot deliver perfect information of all-pervading knowledge. The Vedas are not produced by such imperfect creatures. Vedic knowledge was originally imparted into the heart of Brahma, the first created living being, and Brahma, in his turn, disseminated this knowledge to his sons, disciples, who have handed down the process through his. Since the Lord is Purnam, or all-perfect, there is no possibility of his being subjected to the laws of material nature. However, the entities and inanimate objects are both controlled by the laws of nature and ultimately by the Lord's potency. This Ishopanishad is part of the Yajur Veda, and consequently it contains information concerning the proprietorship of all things existing within this universe. This is contained in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita 4-7, 4-5, where para and apara prakriti are discussed. The elements of nature, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego, all belong to the inferior or material energy Lord, whereas the living being, the organic energy, is the para prakriti, or superior energy of the Lord. Both of the prakritis, or energies, are emanations from the Lord, and ultimately he is the controller of everything that exists. There is nothing in the universe that does not belong either to the para or apara prakriti. Therefore, everything is the property of the Supreme Being. The Supreme Being, the Absolute Personality of Godhead, is a complete person. And he has complete and perfect intelligence. He adjusts everything by means of his different potencies. The Supreme is often compared to fire, and everything organic and inorganic is compared to the heat and light of that fire. Just as fire distributes energy in the form of heat and light, the Lord displays his energy in different ways. He thus remains the ultimate control, sustainer, and dictator of everything. He is the knower of everything, benefactor of everyone. He is full of all inconceivable potency, power, wealth, fame, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. One should therefore be intelligent enough to know that but for the Lord, no one is the proprietor of anything. One should accept those things that are set aside by the Lord as his quota. Cow, for instance, gives milk, but she does not drink milk. She eats grass and grain, and her milk is designated as food for human beings. Such is the arrangement of the Lord, and we should be satisfied with those things that he has kindly set us for us, and we should always consider to whom those things we possess actually belong. Taking notes with reading is a very helpful thing, because there's a lot of information that's being presented here, but it's not just a a shotgun spray of facts. There is a logic or purpose behind how these informations are being presented. So just want to refer to this little outline. As Prabhupada is going first couple paragraphs, two specifically different arguments that arrive at the same conclusion are there to establish that Vedic knowledge is not the same as that knowledge that's created by an imperfect person. Vedic knowledge, first of all, is coming directly from the Supreme Lord. Kind of knowledge coming directly from the Supreme Lord, the Sanskrit term is a Purusheya, not by a mundane person. Another translation of the Purusheya is also here, infallible. So that's what's called revealed scripture. Coming directly from the perfect person. So to reiterate the same point, Prabhupada uses the word Purnam, meaning all perfect. It's saying the same thing, but the argument is slightly different. The conclusion is the same, but the argument is a slightly different argument. Because the Lord is Purnam, or all perfect, that distinguishes him from the living entities that are parts of the Lord's energy. Because they're parts of the Lord's energy, they're always under his control. So, under his control, they're subject to laws of a material nature. They're subject, in other words, to the defects of material existence, of material energies. Because the material energies can perform things imperfectly. The material senses are not perfect. The material senses cannot perfectly distinguish everything all the time. That's the nature of material senses. There are mistakes that are made. The perception is not perfect. There is illusion. And there is all cheating. So, because the Lord is for none, the living entities are not for none, they can't present perfect knowledge. The Lord can present perfect knowledge, and present perfect knowledge. That's just the first and starting point of the purport. Then also, hint is made, or indication is made, that not only in this mantra, because this, the first mantra, just like if you're when you make an address or a speech or you write an essay or you want to say something to somebody, important things are, like the lead sentences in a paragraph are very important when you're writing or when you're communicating, because it kind of summarizes everything, and then other things build upon that summary. So, first mantra, very important mantra. And this Vatsya mantra is summarizing, in effect, what the mantras will also support. So, this information about how the Lord is the proprietor is being emphasized and re-emphasized throughout the Isha Upanishad. And that's part of the reason why that is that's what essentially the Yajurveda is doing, or the Isha Upanishad is doing. Information about proprietorship is being presented. So then, what is that? How does that sense of proprietorship become known to us? That's the next thing to talk about. It's very logical, the sequence that's being followed. So, the first information that's being presented is this an apara prakriti. Or another way that Prabhupada is using the same thing is by saying organic and inorganic energy. The thing is that is animate or inanimate, that is within the universe, is both owned and controlled by the Lord. So how that is established, by reference to the scripture, this apara and prakriti. So therefore, then Prabhupada makes a statement, everything nation is either one or the other. this statement, there's no void in creation. Or there's no, we can make this statement just like someone's asking last night in the village, the concept of Satan come in the Vedic city. We don't have that concept. We don't have that concept in the sense that there's some big bad person that's just as powerful as God. And there's always this, you know, heavenly combat going on between God and Satan, as sometimes they have the idea in Christianity. But there is nothing existence in this material creation other than the para and apara prakriti. Of course, Paramatma is also here, but also not here, transcendentally situated. So since everything in the cosmos, para and apara prakriti, therefore we can say it's all his property. That means also the living entity, not just the inert matter, but the living entity. They're also the property of God. Then the next way that we can understand how everything is owned and controlled, everything animate or inanimate is owned and controlled, another evidence is the analogy that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is compared to fire many times, several times right here in the Upanishad and throughout the Vedic literature. The Lord is compared to fire and light of the fire, which are essential to fire, they are the two energies, the living entity and matter. So the heat and light of the fire, they're obviously controlled by and existing because of the fire. The prior existence of the fire determines the heat and the light. Therefore, we can say that the fire, or the Lord, is the owner and the controller and the proprietor and the sustainer, because when the fire goes out, the heat and light are also gone. So this relationship is being established. then also the reference to he is full of all conceivable potencies, power, wealth, beauty, knowledge, and renunciation. So that means wherever we see these things manifest, just like heat and light, wherever they're manifest, we know that they're manifest because, heat and light are manifest because the fire. So wherever opulences are manifested, they're being manifested because of the prior existence of the Supreme, who is possessing these opulences. That's the term Bhagavan. One who possesses all opulences. That's the meaning of that. Bhagavan. Then the final example, or the fourth of these examples are being presented so that we can understand how the Lord is the provider of everything animate and inanimate. In practical terms, the example is given of building a house. A house, for instance, is made of earth, wood, stone, and then so many other material things. And if we think in terms of the Upanishad, we must know that we cannot produce any of these materials ourselves. We can simply bring together and transform them into different shapes by using our earth. A laborer cannot claim to be a proprietor of a thing just because he has worked hard to manufacture it. If you could take your smashed automobile to a body shop for rebuilding, and they rebuild it, and they say, well, I rebuilt it, so it's mine. Or you pay a contractor, here's money to go buy bricks and cement and mortar and stone and wood and all these things, and after building it, he says, okay, you gave me the money for the ingredients, but I put it together, so it's mine. You won't find in any system of government. In communism, they don't say that. They say that everything belongs to the state. Even you have to pay someone for their labor, but because of the labor, they can't claim that they own it. But the owner is the one who produced those ingredients, and that's God. Who can say to produce those ingredients except God? In modern society, there is always a great quarrel between the laborers and the capitalists. This quarrel has taken an international shape, and the world is in danger. Men face one another in enmity and snarl just like cats and dogs. Sri Upanishad cannot give advice to the cats and dogs, but it can deliver the message of Godhead to a man through bona fide acharyas, or holy teachers. The human race should take the Vedic wisdom of Isha Upanishad and not quarrel over material possessions. One must be satisfied with whatever privileges are given to him by the mercy of the Lord. There can be no peace, communist or capitalist or any other party, proprietorship over the resources of nature, which are entirely the property of the Lord. The capitalists cannot curb the communists simply by political maneuvering, nor can the communists defeat the capitalists simply by fighting for stolen bread. If they do not recognize the proprietorship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all the property that they claim to be their own is stolen. Consequently, they will be liable to punishment by the laws of nature. Nuclear bombs are in the hands of both communists and capitalists, and if both do not recognize the proprietorship of the Supreme Lord, it is certain that these bombs will ultimately ruin both parties. Thus, in order to save themselves and bring peace to both parties must follow the instructions of Sri Upanishad. Human beings are not meant to quarrel like cats and dogs. They must be intelligent enough to realize the importance and aim of human life. The Vedic literatures are compiled for humanity and not for cats and dogs. Cats and dogs can kill other animals for food without incurring sin. But if a man kills an animal for the satisfaction of uncontrolled taste buds, he is responsible for breaking the laws of nature. Consequently, he must be punished. The standard of life of human beings cannot be applied to animals. The tiger does not eat wheat or drink cow's milk because he's been given food in the shape of animal flesh. There are many animals and birds that are either vegetarian or carnivorous, but none of them transgress the laws of nature, as these laws have been ordained by the will of God. Animals, reptiles, and other lower forms of strictly adhere to the laws of nature. Therefore, there is no question for them, nor are the Vedic instructions meant for them. Human life alone is a life of responsibility. This sentence, this paragraph here, is continued at the very end, where Prabhupada has explained that it's a very simple concept, but because lower life forms are compelled to act according to laws of nature, they don't violate the laws of nature. So there's no sin. But in the human form of life, higher intelligence is given, and that higher intelligence is meant to be governed by Vedic injunctions, or God-given injunctions, God-given law. And because of the capacity to live according to the injunctions instead of simply being forced by the laws of nature, then there's responsibility to follow. And one who does not follow, that's an irresponsible life or sin. And with that sin, then there's reaction for the sin. There isn't responsibility in the same way because it isn't the same facility in the same way. So lower life forms are forced to follow the law of nature, and human life is given the opportunity to follow higher than the laws of nature, to accept that higher than the laws of nature is also distinct. It means higher than the laws of nature means recognizing, using that higher faculty to understand that the real proprietor is God, in this, using this context. This is like this about a dog, but if you walk by someone's house that they have, and they have a dog, As soon as you come near their property, the dog begins barking. Bow wow, stay away. Listen. And human mentality that does the same is no different than cats and dogs. This is my little plot where I'm sitting and don't come near. You come near and I'll bare my teeth and slap you. And then the big puffed up dog struts around a bigger area where it's hidden instead of just a little plot where he's sitting. And that's civilized life. That's simply polished animal life. Yet the human's life is simply doing the same. Even the pauper is proud of his penny. So where the dog is sitting in his little bedding area, or has the bigger area, the big mud of the block, and all the other muds that he just beats him up. He's the king of the block. So whether it's the skull is very small, what one is proud of and considers oneself to be the control of and the proprietor of, or whether it's greater, but one's not better than the other, or the other's not worse than the other, it's all leading one to a hellish animalism. Because it's not using the human faculty. Whether one's capacity is very, very tiny, or very great, for performing activity. That's not the criterion for transcendence. The criterion for transcendence is using the human faculty to understand that Krishna owns everything. Even if the concept is so simple that even a child can understand. It doesn't require big, big brain to understand. What we were describing earlier, the big, big brain often becomes proud of how big his brain is, and therefore becomes unable, due to lack of humility, thinking I'm so big and important, to understand something that's very simple. Then one can't understand even simple things and submit humbly before God that you are actually the proprietor, you are actually the controller of this body, of this intelligence, and even of the soul. Everything belongs to you. It's simple to understand for those who are simple. And those whose mind and intelligence are being misused to try to imitate or pretend to be in the position of the controller, then life becomes a bit complicated.
But I don't understand that. You stick with a shepherd. Let me say that in animal life is less than. This would mean that, for example, a human form of life, no?
You're not perpetuating any further sin. Not creating any further sin.
But the losing God's property, not.
That's right. Because that's again, as these laws have been ordained by the will of God, none of them transgress the laws of nature, as these laws have been ordained by the will of God. Jiva jiva sa jivanam. There, God has created forms as food. They're compelled. There's no sin because they're compelled completely. There isn't even a choice for them to do anything other than simply be pushed around, bullied around by the material energy. There is an alternative for them. But in the human form of life, because of developed consciousness, there is the alternative of making another choice, recognizing what is fit with unfit food, or what is fit and unfit action in different circumstances. What is fit is determined by God. for the human form of life, as it is also determined other forms. So the other forms have no sin because they can act other than is determined by God, and a human form can act other than what is determined by God. They have that option. What is to control them is the injunctions of the Scripture. So you can voluntarily submit to those injunctions or not. Animals don't have that choice. As Prabhupada says, this message of the Vedic is not for the snarling cats and dogs. It's not meant for them. It's meant for the human form of life. So to pay attention to it or to not pay attention to it, the ability to do that carries with it responsibility. You understand? Later on, this is explained. As this point is being made here, it's carried later on also. The example that Prabhupada gives later on is when a very highly placed government officer has much greater facility than a little clerk. And why is it they have a greater facility? Because they had a responsibility. That's why. But if they misuse that facility, then it is a very serious thing. If a high-ranking government official breaks off, it's taken far more serious than the run-of-the-mill clerk that breaks the law.
So when animals, for example, attack even these living human beings and kill them, it is being used by nature to inflict some punishment.
Right. No. No reaction.
So the example about the clerk and the official, I think you mentioned that to the high official has more
facility.
So he says he has more responsibility, also has more capability. That's why under that position he has more potential ability to know about his personal life.
Which he's supposed to.
He's supposed to. And his misuse is much more
serious.
Mm-hmm. You know, they're thinking about the animals. They're more suffering and guilt than they're incurring now.
This means that if someone, an embodied soul in a form of life, told them in love, if one gets chance to hear the Holy Land in some words, that is, he's obliged to go through all the ages.
Gradual practice. But if by great fortune that living entity becomes engaged or comes in contact somehow with the process of devotional service, Prabhupada described that they many life forms. Meaning, receive great spiritual benefit. Is this scripture you call? I heard one morning walk conversation where the voice was trying to pin Prabhupada down to saying, do they in the neck come to the human form? He wouldn't say. But he said that they skip many lines and come more directly to the human life form. So by taking, like some of this argument, well, you know, there's violence too when you're vegetarian. So this is one of the points that Prabhupada's making about the next section. We're not just a vegetarian society. Because food can be offered to Krishna, If you take the apple from the tree, apple tree, or the tomato from the tomato plant, or the whatever, then that soul is relieved from the unnecessary gradual evolutionary process, and you can go with it to the uniform. That's the various thing for that living entity. Well, that is devotional service, to produce a fruit that is offered to Krishna. That devotional service. They're not a future thing. Immediately being engaged in Krishna service.
There's a concept about as one progresses through the different categories of species, beginning with water, except for the plants, and into the cows, and such. So, that the consciousness becomes less covered as you gradually progress. So it seems to be an element of intervention by the Lord. The soul can come out of a plant form or some low form and make a great leap. It seems that the Lord is intervening to call that soul to inhabit a higher form.
The Lord's mercy is intervening, but the agent of that intervening is the devotee.
Yeah. Maybe you would think, well, the consciousness in the tree is so dull, maybe it suddenly you get a human form and just you don't seem to be ready for it. And it's like, he's purified by it. And the super soul is purifying by living out in that state.
That's the potency of emotion, sir. That's like our condition. Omagyana Timaran Hasya, we were wandering in the darkness of ignorance. And by the mercy of Vaishnavas, tightly closed eyes are being forced open with the torchlight of knowledge. Or like Prabhupada was praying at an arrival prayer, how they're going to understand this message of Vasudeva, of pure goodness, because here is only manifestation of ignorance and passion. And how, my dear Lord, if you want, you can make my speech such that people can understand. The mercy of the Lord coming through his devotee. We're like the stuff within the plant, practically, so much covered. And yet, by the mercy of the pure devotee, being introduced to the process of devotional service. It is reconsidered that simply by becoming a vegetarian, one can avoid transgressing the laws of nature. Vegetables also have life. It is nature's law that one living being is meant to feed another. Thus one should not be proud of being a strictarian. The point is to recognize the Supreme Lord. Animals do not have developed consciousness by which to recognize the Lord. But a human being is sufficiently intelligent to take lessons from Vedic literatures and thereby know how the laws of nature are working and derive profit knowledge. If a man neglects the instructions of the Vedic literatures, his life becomes very risky. A human being is therefore required to recognize the authority of the Supreme Lord. He must be a devotee of the Lord, offer everything to the Lord's service, and partake of the remnants of foods offered to the Lord. This will enable him to discharge his duty properly. In Bhagavad Gita 9.26, he directly states that he accepts vegetarian food from the hands of a devotee. Therefore, a human being should not only become a strict vegetarian, but also become a devotee of the Lord and offer the Lord all his food. This is these two verses, 9.26 and 13, describe this Isavashan. Recognizing that everything is that animate or inanimate is owned and controlled by the Lord. Therefore, since it belongs to Krishna, it has to be offered to Krishna. In other words, there's some degree of sense in the concern for other living beings. that sentiment also has to be based in knowledge. Why sentiment just for the animal and not for the plant? Rightly placed sentiment is that this plant can benefit. Not only my body can be sustained by not giving unnecessary pain to other living beings, but this plant can be more than that, it can be benefited. It's like the argument that Prabhupada gives out, even the animal sacrifices that are there in the Vedas, it's a very remote part of the Vedic literature, it's not something that's underscored and stressed in repeated fashion. But even in that, the living entity, that the animal that enters into fire, is offered in the sacrificial fire, comes back with a rejuvenated body, a young and youthful body.
A small body then it grows young.
Huh?
Or in a small body then it grows young. How can it come back in a young?
By the power of Vedic mantra. I'm not sure. What's your question?
When he sacrifices once,
yeah,
in the fire, then how, if he comes back, most he can get is a human birth. So if he comes back as a human birth, he has to be a small body, then he has to grow up young and youthful.
So he gets another animal body.
Yeah. Not a human body. Another animal. A rejuvenated animal body of that life form.
But it has to come back as a small one. Then
yeah,
he has
okay.
to grow young.
But the point, so, agreed? That's
right.
Not the ultimate benefit. Certainly it would be very nice if you can enter the fire and receive a human. It would be better, nice if you can enter the fire and not come back in any form for the spiritual world. But the point is that even in that case, the living entity is not undue distress like that of killing. The undue distress is chopping off his head or something.
Yeah, that's good. But something come back as a human murder.
Is it more fair to say that in the case of an animal being sacrificed, the body ritual, when it gets the body back, in his next life, is the soul getting more of that?
There was an interesting discussion on this one. Some technical explanation. What was that sannyasi, the chair from the Bodhi Math, was giving? Yeah, on his point. Some technical point of... I mean, I forget the technical point, but it was real technical. But something to the effect of, yes. That because of being involved in that sacrifice, then in his next life, yeah. Can't remember the details. Can you remember? Remember the discussion? Therefore, a human being should not only become a strict vegetarian, but should also become a devotee of the Lord and offer the Lord all his food. Then only should one partake of prasadam, the mercy of the Lord, mercy of God. A devotee who can act in his consciousness can properly discharge the duty of human life. Those who do not offer their food to the Lord actually eat sin and subject themselves to various types of distress, which are the results of sin. Bhagavad Gita 3.13. Final paragraph. The root of sin is deliberate disobedience of the laws of nature through disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord. This is like a summation of everything else. Yep. The root of sin is deliberate disobedience of the laws of nature through disregarding the proprietorship of the Lord. Disobedience to the laws of nature or the order of the Lord brings ruin to a human being. If one is sober, knows the laws of nature and is not influenced by a necessary attachment or aversion, he is sure to recognize, to be recognized by the Lord, and he is sure to become eligible to go back to Godhead, back to the eternal home. So, just rewinding the picture here, all these different presentations are being made why the Vedas are not to be mistaken as something coming from an ordinary person. And then that these Vedic injunctions make it very clear that all in existence is the energy owned and controlled by God. Therefore, and once that's clearly understood, therefore, one should not take things that you don't require, and even those things that you do accept as what you require, know very well that they also belong to God. That you cannot make yourself and claim yourself to be the proprietor. When that consciousness is there, because that's what then mantra 2 goes on, one who continuously goes on working in that way, one who has that understanding of God as the proprietor of everything, then that is the position of sinless life. You don't involve yourself with karmic activity. Because karmic activity is considering yourself to be the proprietor. The akarma position is also one of eating, moving about, drinking water, interacting with society, using the ingredients of nature, but there's no karma. Simply by this understanding and acting in this understanding. Very same activities that the karmi performs, seemingly externally, same activity. But just different understanding, different consciousness. Different respect that's being given to God as the proprietor and controller. So this proprietorship, they say this about politics. They say it about law. The proprietorship is such an important factor. When governments, you read in history about the establishment of communist government, the establishment of democratic government, and a very essential part in the establishing of those governments is who is the proprietor? Where proprietary considerations come in terms of the government and the citizens. The same is also true in spiritual law. Who is the proprietor? In God's law, it's also there. So Prabhupada says, religious person means one who follows the laws of God. Whatever religion you might want to consider somebody as being part of or not part of, a truly religious person is one who follows God's law. Not just professes, I believe in God, or accept God. But they follow God's law. A part of this law is how you deal with, like they say, ownership is 9/10 of the law. Well, here, spiritual functioning on the transcendental position is 100% of the law. Recognize that Krishna is the proprietor. Then there's only one thing to do, act as the servant, as a subordinate to the master. Because if you don't, you're breaking the law. You try to make that property your property, punishment follows. Misery follows. The root cause of sin is deliberate disregard of the proprietorship of God. Any comments, discussions? Running out of time. Okay. Thank you.